Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Hey, David. Good. How are you?
Doing well. Pretty interesting week from a macro perspective.
Yeah.
I think that Bitcoin's price took a hit this week. I believe that started this week, right?
It did. It was, yeah. I mean, took a hit, right? Over the last 4 weeks, it's been like up around 60, 70. But anyway, it's been in the low to mid 60s this week. People get so short term about this stuff. I think it's fine.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that an important consideration is that the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust is still seeing outflows. Mm-hmm. And could potentially see outflows for the next, 60 days, 100 days, et cetera. And that is a pretty big, negative pressure, essentially.
Interesting.
Well, but it can't last forever.
No. And the main thing is, I mean, thinking about not even super long term, right? But the ETFs haven't been out for that long. It's the most successful ETF launch in the history of ETFs. There's a person on Twitter that has, obviously, if you're on Bitcoin Twitter, Fred Krueger, but he makes an interesting point, which is that a lot of the ETF inflows are coming from retail today. So this is people who like to trade by themselves. They have a brokerage account. Maybe they opened a Fidelity account, Vanguard, and they're clicking directly themselves. Mm-hmm. But what has not really happened, and it will take longer, is for the kind of the advisory wealth to come in, right? So everybody who has like a family office, they work with a financial advisor, and there's sort of some time that it takes for those conversations to happen. What does the right allocation look like? And so that we can expect mid to late this year as those conversations take place and people start to allocate. So we really have seen nothing yet with the ETF. And I think a lot of this, talk about short-term price action really, it's an information asymmetry issue. Like you may not even realize that that a lot of that advisory wealth is going to start to come into Bitcoin in the second half of this year. And if you do realize that, then you might come to the conclusion that Bitcoin is a good deal today. Not financial advice, but that could happen.
Agreed. It not financial advice either, but the conditions become even better for a Bitcoin allocation as rates start to come down and financial conditions loosen. So
And that happened this week, right? Tell us about the dot plot.
Yeah. So the Fed had its FOMC meeting where they talk about the member projections for rate cuts, and there's 19 people that can contribute to the dot plot, which is a summary of the members where they think rate cuts might happen. And Chair Powell gives, or the Federal Reserve Chair gives like a talk for about an hour. And in this one, it was a little bit more, basically the Fed is in a more challenging place because inflation has accelerated a little bit over the past 2 months. And so they are still planning on cuts, but later. However, the overall sentiment is, I think it's solidified that there will be cuts. And so that is interesting to onlookers. It's kind of interesting. Like the stock market was basically like still until the dot plot got released. And then there were like reactions to it. So it's just interesting how much of an impact the projections of 19 or up to 19 people can have on global financial markets.
Right. These 19 people meet in a room, make a decision of what to say. They come out, make a public statement. Their public statement is carefully construed, curated, every single word picked over to try to read between the lines. And then everyone decides what to do with their money after there's kind of this consensus about what was meant.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to believe that we live in a free market where capital is allocated based on, you know, highest need, highest use.
Yeah.
The charade is so obvious at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And it is it's just interesting that, like, it's so intense that, you know, the statements are compared. There's like analysis that is done with respect to the statement from last month versus the statement from this month. And like a lot of times there's no difference besides like a few words, but those words always come out. Like they basically compare last month's statement with this month's and then highlight the changes in red. I think it's called like redlining or something. I forget what the term is, but there's just insane amounts of analysis that is conducted about what the Fed is going to do. So
if I had to, putting on my conspiracy theory hat, I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to time the rate cut such that we see an improvement in asset prices in the economy before the election, but not so far before the election that we also start to see the inflation bite. So it's going to be like, they're going to time it perfectly so that we get the benefit of the election happening after, you know, at least a week or two, maybe month or two of asset inflation or asset prices going up in the stock market, but not consumer prices. And the consumer prices, you know, they don't care whether it's Biden or Trump. They don't care if consumer prices start to inflate after the election because they've got done what they need. It's all about battle space preparation. And so I think that's what they're doing here is they're saying we'll cut, but they're not saying exactly how much or when. I think late summer, if I had to guess, just because of the political situation.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I've seen interesting takes about the Fed's role with the argument that the Fed really exists to protect like asset owners. I think Ben Hunt, the Epsilon Theory guy, he writes that the Fed always takes the side of like capital versus labor, which I think is kind of like
Arthur Hayes talks about that too.
Yeah. So like, if you think like the Fed will protect or try to protect the financial system rather than the, you know, the currency or something else, creates an interesting environment.
Yep. So talking a little bit more about sort of the, you know, the plight of the everyman, I guess. 27% of Americans still think the American dream holds today, and that's down 50% from 2010. Meanwhile, the federal government borrows $10 billion every day to stay afloat. I heard something yesterday about we're heading towards a state where half of our budget is paid to service the debt. That's going to happen like in within the year, I believe. You also have U.S. state pensions being unfunded, and what that means
they're underfunded.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And what that means is if pensions fail, then like older Americans who rely on those pensions, oftentimes they've benefited from asset inflation. There's this funny meme on Twitter about how it shows all these boomers doing a dance. And it's like, these are boomers who bought their house in 1969 for 7 raspberries and they're selling it for $2 million.
Yeah.
And that may happen, right? If pensions start not working, they're going to have to liquidate those assets, and that could really shock the system in a new way that we haven't seen, which is that assets start are starting to be sold in a fire sale, just help people stay afloat.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an understated risk. Another risk is like we talk a lot about commercial real estate, but even where I live currently, Pittsburgh, for example, a lot of the skyscrapers downtown are they're mostly unoccupied. I think it's like 20%, 50% occupation. I'm not sure if I'm using the correct term. It's like 20 to 50% of the offices people actually go into. The leases are full for like the full, you know, office. But when those leases run out, the companies and people who own those leases, I don't think they're going to renew for the full amount because they're not using them. But the thing that is interesting is that these massive buildings cannot be easily retrofitted into apartments or other use cases just based on the way that they've been built. And yeah. So it's another risk.
Yeah. I saw something also about how somebody made a chart of M2 money supply and the top 0.1% of wealth in the United States, and it tracks perfectly. And so this is like the most, this is like a great visualization of the Cantillon effect, which says that, you know, people who are closest to the money printer benefit the most. So as the money supply expands, the wealth of the 0.1% most wealthy people expands. I think it was the bottom 50%. You can see it kind of like dying off as M2 expands. So I'm one of these people who 10, 15 years ago during the Occupy movement, I was like, this is against success and wealth. We shouldn't be in the Occupy movement because like, who cares about the 1%? You know, that's great. They're the productive classes. And they are like, you know, obviously many of the people who are the top 1% are productive and their capital is productive. So I don't mean to say that they're like leeches on the system the way that so many others are. But it's obviously, it's hard to defend that when you expand the money supply, which supposedly is done by the Fed to like prevent unemployment, to stabilize the currency and protect it, it's enriching the 0.1% on like a one-to-one basis almost. And the lower classes and middle classes are suffering.
Yeah, I think that really cuts at the heart of why people might think that the American dream no longer holds. Although it's a lot of people don't make that connection, unfortunately, just based on like an information gap. I think a lot of people don't learn money and banking in school, so they fall into traps and blame others or other reasons. And so one thing I thought was interesting this week that I discovered was gold beans.
Yeah. What's a gold bean?
Yeah, it's really interesting. They're very tiny, kind of like about the size of like a stud earring almost, but there's no obviously sharp tip. They're just like little beads. But each one is roughly like a gram of gold. So around $130, $140, something like that. And so people or citizens in China, it's become a trend on like Chinese social media and for young people to buy these gold beans. And in addition to buying Bitcoin, and the reason for that, which is unlike what's going on in the US, is that the Chinese stock market has been pretty bad for the last few years. And so, you know, America, you know, criticize America. There are lots of, you know, issues like the ones we just discussed, but our equities market is at least for the past few years has gone up a lot. And so I think that might explain why, people here aren't buying, you know, gold beans and Bitcoin en masse like young people in China are, but they're basically buying these products to protect their wealth because they like don't have anything else. So it's like a desperation thing. And
Interesting that it's a Gen Z. Interesting too that's a Gen Z phenomenon, and you know, and that it's because and that it's a viral phenomenon. You know what's cool about these? I'm looking at them right now. It's like there's like this vial. It's like a little glass vial, and it has some Chinese text on it. And then inside are these little like dots of gold. It's actually kind of like a splendid little thing to have. Like I wish I had that. I feel like the format of gold, you know, maybe gold eagles and sort of the old school like gold formats, like the little ingots and the like. I don't maybe there's almost like a generational like appeal. Like maybe we need, if the gold people out there, if you're listening, like think about your formats. You know, make something that like is social media friendly, feels kind of like new and fun and collectible. Maybe the eagle format, the tried and true thing, like it's for a certain type of consumer, but not for another one, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the fact that you can buy the gold beans in like smaller form is more appealing, because I think the cost of buying like a gold eagle on, you know, JM Bullion or whatever site online, it's like $2,000 and some dollars. That's for a lot of like younger people, that seems just like a big allocation when you compare it to buying some stocks on Robinhood, right? Like that's like what the comparison is, and it's just kind of like a big, it's like scary to buy a lot of
These are cool
gold.
Well, so that brings us to other forms of non-gold. Okay, Ethereum. So there's been so much talk about Ethereum being approved for a spot ETF. All the ETH people look at the Bitcoin ETF and they're all jealous and they want, you know, money to be able to be spent on Ethereum ETFs. But they may get the kind of their wish, but they may not get what they want. So the problem is what they're pushing for, really more than just an ETF, is for the SEC to rule or opine upon the status of Ethereum as a security or not. And if it's a security, you know, ETF aside, it may be subject to a lot more regulation than it is today, right?
Yeah. And I mean, so the SEC has allegedly issued subpoenas to companies signaling that it might classify Ether as a security, which would make it extremely challenging for platforms to offer these various like ETH staking things like they have, basically. So it would say you're like a crypto casino and you offer all of these different ETH, I don't want to call them investments, but like ETH products. Offerings. Yeah, products. It basically, this would make it a lot harder for you as the casino to offer those, because you'd have to like go through all of the hoops, the SEC's hoops to do so.
Right.
And that's very hard. And so it would dramatically alter the DeFi landscape's like legal status. But what's interesting is that the CFTC in a lot of rulings like classifies ETH as a commodity. And so there's like a struggle between the SEC and the CFTC if the SEC goes out and does this. And so it's just it's a complete mess. And I think what started it, at least, I mean, it was definitely accelerated when ETH shifted to proof of stake, I think.
Sure. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, everything, it's funny because this is all just sort of what everybody expected and said would happen. It's just happening in a very like tumultuous way, right?
Yeah.
But like we've always known that Bitcoin is a commodity. It's permissionless. It has a proof of work system. It doesn't have a management team. It doesn't have a controlling, you know, board or marketing team, none of these things. Ethereum does. And then they it used to be proof of work, which made it more like a commodity, but now it's proof of stake. And so, and people said way back then when they were talking about the merge or whatever they were calling it, that that this was going to position it as a security. And here we have this kind of showdown. Of course, there would be a showdown because there's so many interests, but it seems like things are trending to kind of the expectation that we all had this whole time.
Yeah, because like, I mean, just fundamentally, like, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, but like, you get like a native yield from staking ETH.
Yeah.
You don't, I don't know. It just seems like, and then you have like stable coins, like synthetic stable coins, like Athena is a big one that has, it's only outside of the US, but there's like $1 billion already in this stable coin. And it's like it's a synthetic stable coin that they've somehow created or that the team has issued. And it like uses that ETH yield to create like a dollar stable coin that gives you a yield. I mean, that to me, that sounds like a fixed income product. Like all of this seems like some sort of, you know, it seems to me like crypto fixed income. But yeah, it's
interesting.
Interesting stuff. You know what?
Why don't we skip? Because this is why don't we skip to talking about like what money is and why Bitcoin is scarcer than you think and why it doesn't matter? Because this comes down to the nature of money and the nature of Bitcoin. And I thought you wrote a really interesting piece. You talked about you referred to Murray Rothbard writing about gold. And what you talked about in this little essay I have in front of me is about how the number of units of money in a money supply, if it is used as money, the number of units doesn't matter. And perhaps that's counterintuitive because you might think that you need some number of units to enable a certain volume of trade. But you know, I think what really matters more than the number of units is the purchasing power of those units, which can float against the number of units, right? So if you have fewer units, but you have more demand for the money and more productive uses for the money, then the purchasing power of each individual unit will just change. And so playing with the number of units really, in fact, not only does it not help you, but it harms you because it distorts price signals. Do you want to say a little more about what you wrote?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that a lot of people have made the argument over the past 100 years or so that we need to, or that the money supply should be increased in correspondence with other metrics in order to maintain some sort of like monetary equilibrium. In the same sense of like, if you think about like the demand or supply and demand charts. However, money is just another economic good. And so if you try to mess with that by kind of like, you know, through non-market ways, it can introduce like a mismatch and distort price signals, like you said, and result in effects like the Cantillon effect and stuff like that, and cause lots of issues within the business cycle. And so what is interesting, if you think about it really from like first principles, is that you don't necessarily need to like constantly increase the units, as you just need to you really just need to have like some amount of units in order to have a functioning like form of money. And that what's interesting about Bitcoin is that it has this fixed total supply that can never be mined. And so you basically have, Satoshi basically made this calculation where there won't be like new Bitcoins being issued that correspond with like economic growth or whatever, like we have with the Fed or other monetary standards. So you swap that for, I forget what, Pierre Richard has an interesting, he has an interesting way of discussing this. I believe he calls it, yeah, there we go. So he calls it money supply certainty. So there's this trade-off between like potential exchange rate volatility and money supply certainty. And with Bitcoin, you maximize money supply certainty versus exchange rate volatility. And so you can still have a healthy functioning economy with this exchange rate volatility. People just adjust. And you would expect if everybody's using that money that people just, the economy just kind of adjusts. However, that concept is kind of challenging for a lot of people to grasp at the outset. And especially because we're about 100 years off of any sort of semblance of like gold standard or something like that.
Yeah, that's great. I think we can, can I close with reading the Murray Rothbard quote? Because it's really cool.
Yeah, sure. And it's a good quote. And there's so much to unpack with this topic that my ramble was good place to start, but there's so much that one can read about.
And especially
this,
because this has never been possible before. So it was always the theory that what would happen if you had a perfectly predictable money supply, but it's literally never been possible until Bitcoin. It was an invention or a scientific discovery.
Discovery. Yes.
So, yeah. Right. An increase in the money supply then only dilutes the effectiveness of each gold ounce. On the other hand, a fall in the supply of money raises the power of each gold ounce to do its work. We come to the startling truth that it doesn't matter what the supply of money is. Any supply will do as well as any other supply. The free market will simply adjust by changing the purchasing power or effectiveness of the gold unit. There is no need to tamper with the market in order to alter the money supply that it determines. And I would just caveat that he was speaking again from a time where we hadn't discovered Bitcoin. So the phrase any supply will do as well as any other supply, that doesn't speak to one form of money being scarcer than another or more predictable than another, but that is actually also a factor. So anyway, because there's actually even been this debate online this week about, is Bitcoin scarce because you can get it whenever you want? Like it's not hard to find. So there's like this weird, there's like a linguistic argument right now being like, do we really want to use the term scarce? Cause that kind of puts you in a scarcity mindset instead of an abundance mindset. And it like freaks you out a little bit. It's like a negative term that's supposed to make you feel like, oh gosh, I don't have enough. Like maybe I'll go get, so maybe we should talk about abundance more, but I mean, there might be an emotional like tinge to the word scarcity, and that might be I guess that's a fair argument, but scarcity just by its
that's interesting.
It means that it's not the units, the number of units specifically is not abundant. It is scarce and predictable. So yeah.
Scarcity matters. Scarcity is why economics exists as a discipline. Some people like to pretend scarcity does not matter.
You, David. And have everybody have a wonderful weekend. And we will talk to you next week.
Yeah. Enjoy.
All right. Take care, everyone.